Today is a bit of a turning point seasonally. It doesn't look it or feel it, but it is seasonally a bit of a turning point. As we are now 40 days plus Sundays away from Easter, which makes this, for those of you who use the word, the season of Lent. For those of you that don't, that's fine too. But I do know for a fact that you're a mixed bunch. Some of you do observe Lent. I'm not going to out you to everybody else, but I know that some of you do and some of you don't. And so I try to offer something for all of you. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But as we begin this season leading us towards Easter, we are entering weeks of some deliberate reflection. One thing I noticed as I looked at the texts and the gospel readings for this season coming up is all of them ask a question. Questions are some of the most interesting things that happen in the gospels. Whether it's Jesus asking them or somebody asking questions of Jesus, these questions are always vitally important. And rather than rushing ahead to an Easter celebration, if we can slow down, if we can listen more carefully, we can pay attention to these questions that are arising in the presence of Christ. So throughout these weeks, I want you to notice that when people approach Jesus, they approach him with expectation. Some of them are bold, some of them are confused, some are grieving. Again and again, questions are asked, and again, Jesus reveals who he truly is, often beyond anyone's anticipations. Our theme for this season is looking at how he goes beyond those expectations we bring to him, how he operates in the realm beyond what we expect. And it begins in a wilderness with a simple but piercing phrase, "If you are." I want you to watch as we read through this passage. And I know I use my words that don't really make a whole lot of sense here, but I want to double down here. I want you to try to visualize. I want you to try to watch in your head as we read through this reading in Matthew 4 what kind of Messiah Jesus is, what kind of Messiah he refuses to be, and who he reveals himself to be. At this point of the story, the heavens have just opened at the Jordan River. He's just been baptized. As Jesus rises up out of the water, the heavens part, the Spirit descends like a dove, and a voice declares, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I am well pleased." And then he goes into the desert, and he hears this refrain, "If you are that, if you are what the voice says you are, then what are you going to do?" And it's this meeting of those two expectations that I think we find in the wilderness. This moment in which Jesus is challenged by saying, if you are God's son, if you are God's beloved, what are you going to do? What does that look like? What does that mean? It's a moment of clarity. It's a moment of affirmation that he has at this baptismal scene. And then this identity is spoken before any miracles are performed. Love is declared. Before any sermon is preached, the Son is named, before he's done anything. And immediately the Spirit leads him into the wilderness, not as a detour, not as a punishment, not as a mistake. The wilderness is where that identity is formed and tested. The Beloved is led into a place of hunger, into a place of silence, a landscape that is stripped of comfort. There's no audience, there's no applause, there's no fame, there's no crowds, there's no disciples yet, there's no visible success to anything he's done. It's just the Son and a voice that sounds disturbingly familiar. If you are the Son of God, then do these things. That question does not deny what happened at the baptism. It conditions it. If you are who that voice said you are, then prove it. If you are beloved, demonstrate it. If you are powerful, use it. The wilderness becomes the place where the messiahship of Jesus is contested. The issue is not whether Jesus is the Son of God. The issue is what kind of son will he be? The word of the Lord from Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 through 11. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tested by the devil. He fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterward he was famished. The tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." But he answered, It is written, one does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. Then the devil took him to the holy city and placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you. And on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone. Jesus said to him, again it is written, do not put the Lord your God to the test. Again the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory, and he said to him, all these I will give you if you fall down and worship me. Then Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him. And then the devil left him, and suddenly angels came and waited on him. It's a stark scene, yes, 40 days of fasting. Any of you ever make it to 40 days before? That's a long haul. I've known one person who did it, and with the close attention of a doctor the entire time, and he does it every year, and not because he enjoys it, but because it means something to him. But I've watched him go through that, and 40 days of fasting does things to a human body that are, it's not pleasant. He's really hungry at this point. He's probably hungry to the point that he's not feeling hunger anymore. He's really vulnerable at this moment. And he gets this suggestion, if you are the Son of God, if what that voice said in those waters is true, then just make some bread out of these stones. Just throw yourself from the temple. Prove it to everyone. Show them the voice wasn't lying. Show them that you are who the voice from the heavens declared you to be. Take these kingdoms and take your throne now. What are you waiting for? If you are the Son of God, if you're the beloved, if you're God's chosen, then what are you waiting for? Each of these temptations is plausible. If not, they're not temptations. Okay? For them to be temptations, these are real things that Jesus thought, maybe I should. At least for a moment, it had to be plausible. Each one of these is reasonable. Each one of these temptations offers a vision of what the Messiah could look like that was tempting to Jesus. I think that means that along his journey, he honestly thought about these things. At some point, the crowds argued with him enough. The Pharisees, the scribes said, you can't be God's chosen one enough. That at some point, he must have thought, I could show you all. I could throw myself off the temple and I could prove it. It's tempting. Each one of these visions is shaped by performance, by spectacle, by power, by control, that he was really, really tempted to use. These temptations are not outrageous, they're not subtle. They assume that power should serve the self, that identity has to be proven, that he has something to prove to the world. That glory is something he could seize rather than be given. These are the things that Jesus struggles with in this desert. That if he's hungry, he could just feed himself. That if he's protected, he should just show it to everyone. That if he's destined to rule over the kingdoms of the world, that he could secure it efficiently, quickly. He could take command. He could prove what the voice from heaven declares as true. The devil does not tempt Jesus toward evil caricatures of power. He tempts him toward something recognizable, something admirable. He tempts him to be successful. And this is where this wilderness moves uncomfortably close to us. We may not say it out loud, but we often approach God with similar conditions, our own if you are moments. If you are good, then resolve this war. If you care about those who are hungry, then why didn't you turn some stones into bread? If you are loving, why didn't you prevent the suffering of all those people? If you are Lord of the earth, then why do you let these other people play at being lords over the earth? If you are what I believe you to be, and if you are everything you said you are, then do something. See, when we read through Scripture, especially the Gospels, they invite you into some sort of character association by nature. You read the story from a point of view. I'll pass on a piece of advice that was given to me a long, long time ago. If you find yourself reading the Gospels and you're reading from the point of view of Jesus, you're doing it wrong. You're not Jesus. And in this particular story, that only leaves you with one other option: to be the tempter. And so often we do repeat these "if you are" conditional threats, these temptations back at the Lord. These are our words, not just the devil's. This is what we do. This is what we sound like. If you were in class this morning, this is kind of what Habakkuk sounded like. We talk like this sometimes, and sometimes it's a good thing, but sometimes are we not just trying to tempt God and to goad God into giving what we want? To doing it our way? We measure divine faithfulness by our own expectations of what it should look like. So if we hear a voice in the desert say, "You are the Son of God," then we imagine what the Son of God should be, how the Son of God should act, the kinds of things the beloved Son of God should do. This hunger in the wilderness is real. Jesus is not pretending. These stones really could become bread, and a leap from the temple really could silence the critics. A shortcut to political authority really would avoid his suffering down the road. But beneath all of those temptations lies the same distortion, that he, for some reason, needs to prove himself to us. That he, for some reason, actually does need to secure his identity through visible results, that he would need to redefine his calling through immediate power. The wilderness reveals just how deeply we assume that God should operate within the logic of our own efficiency, our own parameters, our own control. So when relief to suffering does not come quickly, or when protection does not appear obvious, when influence does not expand the way that we expect it to, we begin to ask our own versions of the question, "If you are. If you are the Messiah, then why is this happening? If you are God, then why is this thing not changed? If you are all these wonderful things, then why must I wait?" The wilderness is exposing that fragile foundation of our own conditional faith. If he is God, then he needs to prove it. If that logic seems familiar and comfortable, remember which point of view you're reading the story from. Jesus does not argue with this tempter, or often argue with us. He does not perform a miracle to settle the matter. He doesn't attempt to secure the outcome in advance. Instead, he answers with Scripture. But more importantly, he answers with trust. One does not live by bread alone. One lives by every word that comes from the mouth of God. That's not some weird new fad diet plan. That's real trust that God will sustain him. Not his own power, but God will. Do not put the Lord your God to the test. Worship the Lord your God and serve only him. These are not pithy mantras. This is a real expression of, I don't need to prove that I am beloved because God has already declared I am beloved. I don't need to prove that I'm the Messiah because God has already said that I am the Messiah. It's a real trust. These responses, they're not defensive maneuvers. These are doubling down on the revelation that was made in the waters. He refuses to turn divine power inward to his own self-preservation. He refuses spectacle to prove himself. He refuses domination as a path to kingship. In doing that, he reveals that the Messiah is not some display of power It's a display of obedience, of trust, of patience. The beloved son is the one who trusts the father more than he trusts his own power, more than he trusts in the promise of success, more than he trusts in the allure of immediate results. The son of God, the beloved son of God, is one who waits patiently for God and doesn't try to do things on his own way, on his own timeline. And it's here in this moment that God is beyond all expectation. Not weaker than we imagined, but stronger in a way that we just couldn't anticipate. God's not dismissive of human need, but God is unwilling to exploit divine power for self-serving ends. Jesus shows us that identity is grounded in God's love and does not need to be proved through performances. It can afford to wait. It can afford to trust. This is not a Messiah of spectacle. This is a Messiah of trust, of obedience, of love. And that reshapes the whole conversation. If this is who Jesus is, then what does that mean for us as we begin this journey to Easter, this Lenten time? It means that faith is not about testing God. It's about trusting God. And there's a big difference between the two. It means that the words, "if you are going to have to gradually give way to "because you are." Right? That's the move Jesus ultimately makes in the desert here in this temptation moment. He moves from questions of "if you are God's child, then do these things," to "because I'm God's child, I'm not going to do those things. I don't need to." Moving from "if" to "because." It means that we loosen our grip on the expectations that we have on God, the expectations that God should conform to our timetables, to our preferred methods of intervention, and instead we give way to what God is going to do. It's no accident that this first temptation centers on bread, right? He's hungry. There are stones at his feet. You put two and two together, you get magic bread. He could satisfy himself immediately. He could use his divine power to eliminate his own discomfort. No one would fault him for it. But he refuses to make bread for himself because it's not what God has shown him is God's will for that moment. He doesn't want to do this in isolation of God's will. As we begin this season, we're going to invite all of us together collectively. This is a self-reflexive verb tense that we're going to keep inviting one another to that refusal, to the same mentality, the same demonstration of powerlessness that we see in Christ. Rather than focusing on what you could give up, right? Lent is often a time where you get on Facebook and say, "I'm giving up these things for Lent." And then Lent is also a time of 3 days later saying, "I cracked and I didn't give those things up." We're not going to do that, but I do want you to think about what we are choosing to give to those who are hungry in our own community. You might have noticed whenever you came in today that there's several giant boxes posted up kind of everywhere. Claudia made sure to put them in places where you couldn't avoid them. So there's some by the elevator. They're kind of in your way, which is a great idea. And if they're in your way by the elevator on one floor, guess what? They're going to be in your way on another floor too. They're by the entrances and exits. You can avoid them, but we all know they're there, these giant empty boxes. Because we're collecting food for AFAC, the Arlington Food Assistance Center. AFAC has been a partner of this church for a very long time. We periodically will do food drives for them. In particular, I think this season is a great time to do that. Rather than asking you to give up meat except for fish on Fridays, or rather than giving up Coca-Cola products or whatever it is that you might or might not be willing to give up for Lent. Rather than doing that, let's use this time to think about how we can give of what we have to those who have less. That seems in the same spirit of things, but also a lot more productive in a lot of ways. So we're going to help AFAC. They are running out of supplies for the families in this community who need food to survive on. who are looking at stones and wondering if they can eat them, who are looking at churches and saying, if you are God's representatives on this earth, if you are Christ's hands and feet, then where is my food? Well, let's give them some food. Families in our own county are navigating rising costs, limited resources, difficult choices. Hunger is not a theoretical around you. There are people on the metro with you who are hungry. It's not something that happens far away in a war-torn country. It's here. It's present. It's personal. And this is not a way of earning righteousness. This is not a performance of piety. This is not proof that we're serious about faith. It's an act of trust. By sharing what we have, we declare that life does not depend on holding tightly to everything that we have. We confess that bread is ultimately a gift, not a possession. We align ourselves with the kind of Messiah who refused to turn stones into bread for his own sake and instead entrusted himself to God's provision. Right? The spoiler for the story of the temptation in the wilderness is that when Jesus does magically turn something into bread, he doesn't keep any of it for himself. He just gives it away to thousands upon thousands. In bringing food for our neighbors, we are practicing a different logic than what the wilderness offered. We resist this cultural instinct to grasp at stuff. We are resisting this need to depend solely on what we can accumulate. We trust that obedience, that generosity, that shared provision reflects the kingdom of God more clearly than self-protection ever could. In this way, the wilderness becomes not merely a story about Jesus long ago, it's a pattern of our own discipleship. That's the point here. Because Jesus fed the hungry, we feed the hungry. Because Jesus forgave us, we forgive others. So these boxes, they're strikingly empty. We'd like you to fill them up. What kinds of things? Non-perishables, canned fruits and veggies, canned tuna, soups, tomatoes, peanut butter in plastic jars, staples, not actual staples for like a stapler for a paper, but like staples for your pantry, flour, sugar, oil. If you look at the AFAC website, they can give you some more suggestions of things that they're particularly running low on. Highly suggest you look at their website. It's got some good stuff on there. You will all agree with them, though I ran out of room on the slide. They consider coffee a staple. So they need more coffee. You need more coffee. People who are hungry need the same things that you want to have. Think about it that way. This is not an opportunity for you to get rid of things that are expiring in your pantry. I guess you could do it that way. What we're asking you to do is to think about those who are our neighbors who are hungry and what we can do to turn some stones into bread. It's not going to cost you a whole lot. If you notice the things on this list, they're kind of budget items. In fact, everything on this list can be bought at Dollar Tree, just for the record. This is not big budget spenders and breakers. This is not a need to go and buy luxury items, though you could do that too. They just need food for those who are hungry. And the world looks to the church and says, if you are God's church, then turn some stones into bread. And we don't do that as a way of performing. We don't do that to prove ourselves. Instead, we say, because that voice declared that we are children of God, we act like children of God. And this is the kind of thing that children of God do. The wilderness temptation begins with a suggestion that stones turn into bread. It ends with angels taking care of Jesus and ministering to his needs. The son who refused to seize sustenance for himself is sustained by God's direct care. The one who would not perform for applause receives quiet provision instead. And today we come not to test God and not to prove ourselves, not to demand visible signs. We come to receive. Week after week at this table, bread is not manufactured by our own effort or secured by our own control. It is freely given. We do not transform stones into loaves. We receive what the Lord has prepared. Beyond our expectations, we encounter a Messiah who trusts the Father completely and invites us into that same trust. Trust that you could donate some of your own food and your own supplies and be fine. Trust that whenever everyone else is panic buying toilet paper, that you can spare one pack of it and you'll survive. It'll be okay. The bread that we break is a reminder that God's provision does not depend on our performance. The cup that we share declares that love, not domination, defines kingdom. In receiving this meal, we renounce all of that wilderness logic of if you are, and instead we confess that he is. Not if, he is. He is the beloved Son. He is the faithful Messiah. He is the one who took up the cross. He is the one who loves. He is the Lord who trusts, and he has called us to do the same. So come to the table, not to test him, but to trust him. And in trusting him, discover that he is beyond anything you've ever expected. Let's stand and sing.